I want to start the podcast particularly by asking you this because I have been reading your essays for a long time now. And, you know, I'm deeply, deeply impressed with how you write. And I'm not just saying it because you are here, but I do love your writing a lot. And, you know, often during times of block, I went to your Substack and read your personal essays, find things, ideas, sentences, words, and try to use them in mine, not plagiarizing or anything, but just taking inspiration. So I wanted to ask you, like, when you write about a movie, how personal do you go? And what is something as a critique that you always keep in mind? Like, it has always confused me with subjectivity of any film. Like, there is no as such objective truth attached to it, right? Or is there? I just wanted to ask you how that goes with you, you know?
So you're right that there is nothing objective about anything, right? We can go a little, we can push it a little bit more and say, like what Nietzsche said, which is that there are no facts, there are only interpretations.
Yes.
But of course, that's, you're pushing it a little far. But the broad reality is somewhere that we experience art through our bodies, and our bodies are inscribed in the society through race, through caste, through gender, through the movies we watch, the books that we read, the stories that we're told as kids, the teachers that we had. And we bring this body that's uniquely inscribed into every film, into every theater. And so it's natural that we are reacting with that body. So there is no way of, if you're saying that there is an objective way to look at a film, what you're saying is that there is this empty body that's bereft of feeling, of history, of violence, of love, of desire, of all of that, bereft of all of that, and entering the theater.
Right.
And if that is true, it's not true, but if that is true, that is such a dull, boring vision of this world.
What
makes us alive to the world is the abrasiveness of it, right? The desire that we feel, the hypocrisy that we experience, right? Where we know we're supposed to believe something, but we believe something else. We feel something else, but we say something else. And it's in the chafing of these, the performed and the felt, the visceral, that there's something exciting comes out. And it's the expression of that in, through criticism that I find fascinating. And so that can't be objective. That's entirely subjective. That comes from me. But at the same time, as you said, how much of your personal self do you bring into your review? It's a very tricky balance, because the easiest thing to do right now, and there is a glut of the personal essay as a genre, the easiest thing to do is to be indulgent about yourself, right? Because we create narratives of ourselves, of our lives. We live our lives and that's separate. But then we have memories, and then from those memories, we create this narrative that this is how my life was. This is who I am. We create these convenient labels like introvert, extrovert. But the reality is that we're constantly jostling between all of these identities. So the problem with the personal essay and the problem with bringing yourself into your review is that you're bringing your narrative into your review. And what happens is we love to believe the best narrative of ourselves. We don't want to believe the narrative of ourselves that is hateful, that is hurtful, that is violent. When the reality is that that too is our life, that we are capable of just that. But we don't bring that into our narrative, and so we don't bring that into the personal essay. My criticism of the personal essay genre is that, which is that it's too righteous. Personal essays that I love reading are ones that are messy, that make you capable of feeling disgust towards the person who has written that personal essay. Like, would you be able to write a personal essay where you're comfortable with saying something that people are disgusted by? Right? And often the answer is no, because we, the narrative of us is sanitized. It's streamlined. There's a clarity to it. But the reality is that there is no clarity, right? There is no clarity in living our lives. There's constant doubt, there's constant fear. We're constantly provoking our own thoughts. So that's the limitation of bringing your personal self into the review, which is why I try to, as much as possible, remove the eyes from my reviews. It's just a personal fear. There was a time where I used to use I a lot in my reviews. And I get the seduction of it. I get the allure of wanting to insert yourself into a piece and say, it's the side of the ownership, right? Like, this is my piece, this is my life,
Yes,
and
yes,
I'm living
yes.
that. But the problem is that those pieces don't age very well. Because when I go back to those pieces, I feel this very odd sense that I didn't let this idea bake enough, that it seemed very incomplete. But I'm trying to create this very righteous vision of myself, the self that knows what it's talking about, the self that is absolutely clear about their opinions. And the fact is, I'm not. Like when I'm writing a review, many a times I'm very conflicted about what I'm feeling. And I'm moving through that. I'm moving, like, I might love a scene, I might hate another scene, I might be moved by something, I might be disgusted by something, and I'm pulling all of that together. But the moment I bring an I, I'm forced to make it simpler. I'm most forced to make it into that narrative. And so that's why, the truth is that there is no objective experience, that we're bringing our subjective bodies to cinema. In criticism, bringing your subjective self and inscribing your subjective self into that work of criticism is full of minefields that I think we should be. I'm not saying don't use the I, right? If that's what you feel like, do it. Just to be careful about what is it, what is the narrative of yourself that you're creating by positing your self in that review, because it's for posterity, right? This is how
Yes.
you know, this is how you'll be dead. It's an archive, it's part of the archive. So are you comfortable doing that? You know, these are questions that I didn't ask myself when I used to use I a lot, but now when I go back to those pieces and I'm sort of cringing and I'm, you know, really not happy, and I really wished that my editor had told me, just no, remove the eyes, remove the eyes. It's just where I am right now.
But is it a price that you pay for being too free? Like what you talked about, the messiness that happens in personal essays and cringing about ourselves while looking at in with a retrospective lens, right? Is it because we were too free back then? Is it why that happens? Or is it something else?
No, so I don't. You might be right that we felt free, but here is what I have gathered from my limited understanding of myself when I was that age, let's say 23, 22. How old are you?
I'm 18.
18,
I'm 18 as well.
18 and 20. Which is that I used to be very confident when I had an opinion. The moment I had an opinion, I felt confident. And that led me to form more opinions, to want more opinions. Opinions that were clear, opinions that I could defend, opinions that I could get others with, right? It gave me that sense of confidence that I belong to the world. That is so enticing, right? That feeling is so enticing, which is why they always say, and of course it's a joke, but they say it and it's very common, which is that if you're not a communist when you're
Communist at your 20s, you are
or
a pale youth.
you're not in life, right?
Yes.
Because communism is such a seductive idea.
Yes, definitely.
Marxism is so seductive. Like, I still remember the nights that I was reading the Communist Manifesto. I didn't sleep that night. I was reading it the whole night.
True.
It thought,
Definitely.
suddenly looking at the world as a structure, you know? That a structure that you could understand, a structure that you could pare down, a structure that you could revolutionize, a structure that you could dismantle, but a structure nonetheless. So seductive. I grew older. I started recognizing that these structures are a starting point of a conversation. Right? Right? Like how I studied economics. And in economics, we used to have this idea of an assumption. So you create these assumptions. And based on these assumptions, you make your model. Right? Now, once you make your model, it doesn't end there. Then you start destabilizing some of the assumptions that you put. You start moving some of the assumptions. You say, what if? And then your model keeps changing and it becomes more dynamic. And it's the same thing. Like you enter this idea of Marxism and you're seduced by its certainty. And then you start thinking, well, life isn't so certain, life doesn't feel certain. If life doesn't feel certain, why is its interpretation feeling so certain? And then what happens is suddenly you're moving into the ifs and buts, right? But what you're saying about freedom is true, because in that moment when you have an opinion, there's a right and a wrong. And with that right and a wrong, you feel an ease. And maybe it's that ease which you're calling freedom. But what I think, again, I could be very wrong about this, but what I feel is that as you grow older, that ease starts giving way to doubt. And then the way you embrace that ease, you start to doubt, which is where I am right now.
Yeah.
Again, there could be more to this story, and we'll find out 10 years from now. But so, but something is happening.
Yeah.
You see, I was always like, when you were talking, I was just thinking about this, you know, this model of the world that, you know, Jay Krishnamurti proposes in one of my favorite books by him, First and Last Freedom. He says that the world is like an ocean with a storm, and you need things to hold on to. And when you sort of get things to hold on to, you desire an island. And then, you know, slowly and surely, you can be in the shore and be very free of ideologies, which is obviously impossible to do, just to lead your life into chaos. But or you can just build a good hub, a big island where you control your own things and you manage your own things. So,
but that the storm still exists.
The storm still exists.
Yes,
definitely, definitely.
Yeah,
and you have to actually think about it existing. You cannot forget about it.
And you know, I was going to ask you later in the podcast about what is it, why do we romanticize being young? And I also wanted to ask you about growing old. But now, because you have already talked about it, I want to ask you, why do we romanticize this idea of being young? Like, wherever me and Yash go with our pitches for the documentaries, with our pitches of, you know, our scripts, they are like young filmmakers, young writers. Like, are they talking about no relevant experience, or is it something else? And when do you realize, okay, I have grown old. This is I am old. Like, does it occur suddenly, or is it
I'm
late
not young
realization?
Well, I don't know if I have the answer to that. But so, I mean, very broadly, it says that for me, the realization that I am growing old, not that I am old,
of course.
the realization that I'm growing old came when I realized that my parents had a past that I have to now contend with in order to bring them into the future.
Yeah.
Like, suddenly I stopped looking at my parents as caregivers, and I started looking at them as care receivers. So that moment for me was a moment to realize that, okay, now I think I need to pull up my socks a little bit.
Yeah.
In terms of money, in terms of, you know, emotional support, all of that. Why do we romanticize youth is, it's like a twin blade, right? Like, on the one hand, people say that when you're young, you're untouched by the doubts and the complacencies that are inherent in being an adult, right? But on the other hand, there is no experience, right? We've not lived as much. And so there's that constant, you know, it's like Columbus on a boat, right? He's not, it's exciting because you've got, it's without precedent, and there's something exciting about it, but at the same time, there's something very naive about it. And you could land on the shores of a country, or you could walk into a storm.
Yeah.
But it's the very act of being on a boat and sailing forth that is exciting.
Yeah.
And so it's romanticized because on the one hand, it is, well, it is in the past. For most people who romanticize it, it's in the past. Do you all romanticize your youth?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
So the part of romanticizing youth usually comes in retrospect.
Ah, okay.
Right? As memory. And as we know, memory is all constructed. Like, we live the life and then we construct the memory.
Yeah.
Very different.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the idea of a riotous youth is so exciting to say as a story. You want to tell your story to someone over dinner.
Yeah.
That's the story you want to say. You don't want to say a story of a dull teenage life. You want to say a story of a reckless teenage life.
Yes.
So perhaps it comes from there. I don't know. How true it is, how false it is, I don't know. But there's this lovely novel called The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. And what that book does is precisely this. It deconstructs how memory can fool us into believing so much about ourselves that could be really false. You know? And it's lovely. That book is lovely because it really takes you through And it's really funny because I read that book thrice in my life. It's a book, it's as thin as my thumb. It's, you can finish it over a night or two. The first time I read it as a teenager, I was in love with the language of it. And there was the part of the book where, you know, it's a group of friends, right? And the group of friends, they're in college, and they say things to each other like, that's so philosophically self-evident. You know, they would say these sentences and I would mark these sentences and I would try to bring these sentences up.
Yes.
And that's what I reacted to the first time I read it. You know,
yeah.
The excitement of youth, the vocabulary of youth. And then, of course, when I read it much later, I was reacting to something else. I was reacting to how that whole idea of youth was constructed and how that idea of youth, while it illuminates something about our life, it also obscures so much about our life, so much of the violence that we've completely removed it from our memories. So every time I read the book, I'm reacting to a different stage of that book that is somehow corresponding to my stage in life at that time. So I find that very fascinating. But yeah, I hope that answers your question.
No, it does make sense, like in retrospect, the nostalgia thing.
Definitely it does. I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, what makes a great film?
I don't think there is one. Let me just, to feel ravished by a film, however you want to define ravished, that is it. It could be a war film that you're walking out and you're shell-shocked. It could be a romantic film that you walk out swooning from. It could be a coming-of-age Bildungsroman Roman, which you're, you know, really moved by. It could be an erotic film that you're, you know, intensely, I don't know, charged by. It could be anything. Just that feeling of rapture. I think anything that can evoke that in you is great. You know?
Nice.
Yeah, nice. I also wanted to ask you, is it like escapism? Because I wanted to ask you, like, some people, when I've asked this question, that what in your opinion, like, what's a good film? It's like they define it, like they will mold the answer very quickly, but they will basically define that a good film is something that takes me away from what, you know, I'm experiencing. Like, say it's a war film, and it makes me engrossed in the war more than I am in, you know, my daily routines, my daily life. So it does. Is that a part of it? Is that?
As escapist, I've always seen, because I think one is this desire that you need to escape life. And very odd, because what cinema does for me is it grounds me deeper into it. Right?
Wow.
That's what good cinema does. It grounds you deeper into it. It makes you feel things more intensely. And would you call feeling more intensely escaping from the world or being participating in it?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Okay, if you're watching a really good rom-com, like you're saying that's escapist. But what is that rom-com making you feel? It's making you feel charmed. It's making you feel...
Yeah.
It's making you savor the sweetness of life, right?
Is
that not you participating in the world then? So... I suppose it's more philosophical distinction that I want to make, and dismissing this idea that by watching films we are escaping life. It's as if saying that this is life, and then there's this vacuum sealed theater watching the film and coming back to life, which I don't think it's that neat, right? I don't think we leave the world behind when we walk into the theater.
Definitely.
Like, even the idealistic part of cinema can, like, for you it does that, right? Even how much, however idealist it that is, it brings you more closer to life, right? That's what you're trying to say here. Yeah. And you know, I often ask this to my teachers and professors. One of my electives is political science, right? And I wanted to discuss this thing that happens with me very often is, because of the impending culture upon us, everyone's acknowledging their privilege right now, right? And while we were, there's a board game called Shashan. I don't know if you know about Shashan, right?
So
we
were playing. Yes.
So we were playing Shashan, and there's this thing where you have to check your privilege.
In a case of a draw,
huh?
The person, it's a political game, right? So you win an election. In the case of a draw, the person with the most privilege.
How do you calculate that?
It's on a website.
It's a website.
And it asks you what your income is, what caste are you, and everything. It asks you like very deep. And so, it tells you what your privilege is.
Huh. So I wanted to, you know, ask or discuss is like, have you ever felt this guilt, not pity over yourself or pity over others, but this guilt just because of where you in the society are, ki, oh, fuck, I'm here. And there are many people below me financially, socially. So do you ever feel guilt? Ki, like, I often feel this guilty sense of feeling when I think about my privilege, you know, and I don't know how to get over it. Like, acknowledgement is one thing, but how do you get over that? Like, what's the next step? Is it, do you become a socialist? Do you become a politician, or what do you do? Like, have you ever felt this feeling?
I mean, if you do feel guilt, I don't think the logical next step, I don't think there is a logical next step. I think if the guilt is it,
I agree.
The point of feeling guilt is not entirely, but partly a compensation for the privilege that you're accessing. Right? Mm. I suppose. I'm not entirely sure. So I have not felt guilt as much as a helplessness with what to do with the privilege that I have, right? Because I'm a Brahmin. And so when I was, when I moved into adolescence, I did the Poonal. I got the Poonal, which is our...
Yes. Yes.
You.
So we call it the Poonal. Mm. And I participated very, very vigorously in that culture. And then, of course, you read Ambedkar's Annihilation of Caste, and then you realize what is going on. And then you remove the Poonal. And you keep it aside. You're like, I don't think I want to wear this. I don't want this on my body. You're recognizing that it's a futile act. Not doing anything. You're not making anyone's life any better. Act except alleviating some of the, perhaps guilt is the word. I don't know if that's the right word, but that's a close approximation that you feel.
Yeah.
And I don't think there is any way out of it. I think the only way is to ground deeper into it. One of the fears that I have is feeling comfortable with this guilt. Right? You'll come to a point where you're not disturbed by guilt anymore. And I'm worried about that moment. Like, what does that moment mean? How will that moment feel?
Is it the moment of not caring anymore?
I don't know if it's not caring, really. I don't know what that's going to feel like, right? Because guilt is inherently supposed to make you feel things. But what if it stops making you feel things? Is it guilt anymore? You know, what is it? What does guilt become? Will it become? Will it atrophy? Will it become more, I don't know, cancerous? What's going to happen to that guilt? Is it going to curdle? Is it going to become resentment? Because it's so easy for guilt to become resentment.
Yeah, definitely.
True. Who are you going to resent? Are you going to resent the people who are making you feel guilty?
Or yourself.
Guilty? So, I don't know. I'm not the right person to ask this question to, perhaps. But
Right.
Yeah.
Nice.
I wanted to also ask you, I mean, it's just curiosity, okay? I wanted to ask you, have you gotten this sort of spoiler vision where, you know, you've sat through enough movies to, you know, predict through pattern recognition alone, okay, what's the plot alone like going to be?
I mean, of course, in the
movie,
that's kind of criticism, it comes from common sense.
But how much does that hinder your, you know, viewing of?
So far I've never felt that. Like this whole idea of this whole criticism that films are predictable. As a criticism has never made sense to me.
Because
sometimes I'll know the ending. Like, why do I watch the same film 10 times if I know it's predictable? Because it's the capacity of that film to hold me in that moment. So even if a film is predictable, the criticism is not that you are able to predict the end, but the criticism is that the film is so dull that you're constantly predicting the end. Criticism changes off that work. You're not so much talking about the ending, but about what is leading to that ending. And so for me, that's never an issue. Like a predictable ending is never an issue. A dull film is an issue. But a film that's not able to ground me in it is an issue.
Nice.
Also, you know, like I wanted to ask you what you are reading currently, because you have stopped posting about what you read, and so I just wanted to ask you what you're reading.
So, the problem with Substack is, so what happened was I started the Substack because I wanted to just vomit words out that were there. But then it got read by an editor for the Frontline magazine. So then that got converted into a column. So now that what would generally go into the Substack comes in the Frontline magazine. It's a column for counterculture. And so, of course, I've been posting far less frequently on it. So right now, the problem is I'm reading a lot. So like a lot of books simultaneously. So, but just right now, before this call, I was reading this essay Against Interpretation by Susan Sontag.
Nice.
Because I loved, and I wanted to, I don't know if we're going to have a chance to talk about this here, but I just wanted to have a sense of what it, like her clarity is very, very sexy. I find it very erotic and sexy. And so in this, she talks against interpretation. She says like, how we are so forced to divide the world into form and substance.
Yeah.
Right? And how that's such a false division that we have created and that we buy into. And because we divide the world into form and substance, we want interpretation. We want someone to interpret the substance for us. And how this interpretation impoverishes it. How interpretation is the ending of art, truly, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I've been reading... on my bedside, there are really three books. One is Conversations Between Ejaz Ahmed, who's this really renowned Marxist who passed away, and his conversation with Vijay Prashad. Then I'm reading Devika Rani's biography. I don't know if you'll have watched Jubilee.
Yes, I've been currently watching Jubilee. I'm on the third episode, I guess.
He's talking about it as well.
So Sumitra Rani's character is very loosely based on Devika Rani.
Achha.
And so her book, The Longest Kiss, I'm reading that. And simultaneously, I'm reading an audiobook. So I want to finish. So Perumal Murugan is this Tamil writer. He got his book, Paya, got longlisted for the International Book Corps. The first Tamil book to ever do that. And so I'm just reading all his books on Audible.
Nice.
Always at any given point of time, it's just chaos. Like my bedside is like 10 books, my girl.
Yeah, I can get that.
Books.
Yeah.
I sound like I'm complaining about it, but I'm actually very happy about this life. I think I'm in a life where I'm moving from one book to another in this linear form, perhaps too dull. Mm. But the flip side of it is it gets overwhelming sometimes.
True. Yeah. Are you watching Succession right now?
I was going to ask the
same. I right after this call, I'm going to watch the next episode, the latest one.
Okay. Oh.
You have not watched the recent episode?
No,
don't tell him anything. Don't.
I will murder you from here.
Yeah. Shut up.
Fast in Ahmedabad.
Yeah. But it's...
I do hope this call gets over early and you get to start the episode very soon.
Let's
just move over it. You know, I want to ask you, because I can't stop my excitement over Succession. Later in life, if you get chance. But like, you know, because your job has now become critiquing, does it ever feel boring, or do you ever think, oh fuck, I have to, you know, we wake up early and go to see a movie tomorrow and then write about it? Does it ever take the fun away?
So that's the problem when your recreation becomes your labor. Right. One of the big problems that happens is that you start looking at your recreation in terms of labor value. You look at every review you write in terms of what can I be paid for this review. Right? You look at every film as an opportunity to be paid to write about. Suddenly, what this thing that was just floating as recreation, as pleasure, suddenly gets co-opted as labor, and then you don't know what to do with pleasure. Which is why I started reading books. Like when I started doing film criticism, ironically, I started reading more because that became pleasure. But then I did a very stupid thing during the lockdown and started book criticism.
Yeah.
And then that took the joy of reading also. And then I started that because I realized I need something, I need some pleasure.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like the moment, I'm not fatigued by cinema in the sense that I don't think, oh God, I need to watch a film.
Huh.
It's that sometimes I'm overwhelmed by how much I have to watch. So the pleasure of watching gets tainted by the pressure. So the pleasure gets tainted by the pressure. And it gets a little worse. So I also do curation, right? I started doing curation. So I'm working with a few film festivals right now, for which I have to watch like 100 to 150 films over the next 5 months, which is like at least a film a day.
Yeah.
This is in addition to watching films, which is my day job.
Yeah.
So it gets a little, the pressure builds. But what really helps is I have another job. So I do film companion 3 days a week. And the other 3 days I work for this writer called Devdutt Patnaik. I research film. And that's a very different ball game. It's a very different muscle that I use for that job. I think about different things. I think broader because Devdutt thinks broader. He's not thinking of films. He's thinking about civilization, right?
It's a
broader scope. So that helps. Like I'm not just thinking films, day in, day out. But that being said, it's easy for cinema to become your life and then it becomes your personality and then you become a very dull person to talk to. If cinema becomes your personality, that's what you become dull.
I was just going to ask, are you a half glass full person, half glass empty person?
I mean, if I'm thirsty, I'm going to drink that glass of water. I'm not really going to think too much about it.
Yeah, you're a go with the flow person.
Yeah, I don't, like it also depends on the day, right?
Achha, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree.
True.
So I also, you know, wanted to, I saw this very, also a very curious article, research, definitely. So it was about how like 3,000 or something people, they were surveyed, you know, after watching a movie, after watching several movies. So then they had to rate it, they had to critique it. So it showed that men had like very same opinions, women varied, but individualistically, everyone varied. And no one, it's very unpredictable. It's very volatile, you know, every single person has a different opinion to it. And I wanted to ask, do you believe that if a movie is out there, it's not one movie, it's various movies? Do you believe that?
I mean, it's various movies with the various interpretations of
it. Various interpretations, yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, again, Nietzsche said this, right? Like there are many eyes, and so there are many worldviews, and so there's some truth. There are many eyes, so there are many truths, and so there is no truth.
There is no truth, yes.
And again, it's so easy to like lean into nihilism after that, right?
Say
that
definitely.
There, of course, there are some, that there is climate change, that I am talking to you, that there
yeah.
is, you know, if you want to reject everything, then what are we really doing? But I mean, I don't know how that's helpful. Like, what do you want to build on from that conclusion that there are many films? Like, how does that change the way you look at cinema?
I mean, that doesn't change the way I look at cinema, but you know, if, you know, like what I was building on was that as a person who is, you know, creating a movie, you know, how much, you know, ability does he have to express himself? Or do you think that it's out for the people? It's a form of expression for the people, not for yourself. You know, it's not for the first viewer.
Well, so as an artist, I don't know what to say because I don't make films. So I don't know from that perspective. But as a critic, I know that there is a very potent and a very strong argument that you make for saying that the author is dead. The filmmaker is dead, but then they're dead. Yeah. Don't worry about their intentions because you never really know their intentions. You know, it's like this whole thing of, I don't know, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, like, trust the art, not the artist. You know, don't believe what the artist says about their work, because often what happens is they might have a very dull interpretation of their own work, and you might have more robust.
Yeah.
Disappointed almost by your
yes.
By their interpretation. So yeah, I don't know from the artist's perspective, but certainly like as a viewer, you don't have to. It's not like you don't have to fit the square pegs into round holes, right? Like you don't have to fit your perspective into their perspective. Like their perspective can just float away. You fixate on your perspective, your aesthetic experience. I don't find, and that's the kind of criticism I also hate, which is the kind of criticism
that
predict how other people will respond to it. They're like, fans of this actor will like this movie. How do you know?
Yeah, true.
You know?
Yeah.
If you're a Masi person, you like it. Like, how do you know? Are you a Masi person? You know, if you are a Masi person, then speak from your perspective, right?
Yeah.
Why are you putting yourself, pretending to put yourself in another person's shoes and trying to predict how they would respond to an artistic experience?
Mm.
I just find that whole charade absolute nonsense, like a total waste of time.
Yeah.
And it brings nothing. It brings nothing to criticism. It brings nothing to the movie itself.
Yeah, I get that point. You know, that's what I was trying to ask. Like, people do that. They'll be like, you know, like that study basically concluded that even critiques such as Roger Abbott or like even their analysis of a film didn't match with any one of it.
Of course.
Didn't match with any single one. But what it also added was that critiques among themselves agreed with each other's interpretations. So that's what I was, you know, trying to look. And that was, I was curious about that. But yeah, that's the answer that satisfies me because I get it now. Yeah.
Also, because of the painting behind you, know, I want to ask you, like, do you believe in God or are you an atheist?
Oh, I am an atheist. So this is a Patachitra. I love, but like, so I find no solace or certainty or pleasure in the idea of God. I find a lot of aesthetic pleasure in the idea of God. My parents are believers in God, and so we have a lot of these statues and images around. I'm very interested in the aesthetic of it. So I love going to temples because I love looking at temple architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened is I became an atheist, and then at least when I was a teenage atheist, I was so proud of my atheism. I rejected everything about God, including the aesthetics.
Yeah.
Right? And then what happened is over time I came to appreciate the beauty of the art around God, right? Gorgeous, gorgeous paintings.
Yes.
Hampi, like these temples, these old cave temples that I visited. I mean, to see the Ravan Anugraha, which brought me to tears because it was so, like these are things carved in the 6th, 7th century that still exist.
Yeah.
You know, going to Kaneri Caves here, Elephanta and Bombay. So these things came much later when I recognized that I don't have to throw the baby with the bathwater, sort of, right? If I don't believe in God because it makes logically, emotionally, it makes no sense to me. But there's so much around it that I'm moved by. Why do I have to reject that?
Nice.
Look at it. Isn't it gorgeous?
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I get your point. Like, I love the stories as well. You know, they have like great pacing and all. Like the Mahabharata and all. So yeah, I love that as well.
True. And you know, I think we should end the podcast. But before I end it, I just want to ask you, you know, the photos that you click and post on Instagram, you know, the stories.
You should ask this or not, but he's asking it.
Like, is that a filter or is it your camera?
Well, it is the camera and the filter. So this is what I do, right? Which is that I'm very interested in that intensity of experience.
Uh-huh.
So when I look at the sky and it's this gorgeous shade of blue that evokes something very strange inside me, I click it. It's not the same shade.
Okay.
But then I put it on Snapseed and I put a soft filter on it and I increase the contrast and I or do something to the saturation and the blueness of the sky comes out. In a way that evokes a similar feeling. It might not be the same blue.
Yeah.
Evokes a similar approximation. That to me is photography. I'm not interested in capturing the world as it is because I don't find value in it. There might be value that other people might seek. I don't.
Fair.
So I'm essentially creating this archive of feelings through photography. So yeah, it's both the camera and the filter.
And the filter.
Nice. So I guess we should end the podcast now. And thank you for coming. You know, thank you for joining. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Kunal. Thank you, Yasha.
Yes. Yeah. Bye bye.
Thanks a lot, Pratish.